Thank you so much. It's really, it's... It's really a tremendous chus to get called back, to come speak here, you know, to come back home to Oceanside, and it's a, you know, you already know me for so long to be asked to come, and people should come during their vacation to come hear me speak. It's an even bigger chus. Totally flattered by the offer to come and to share some words of Divrei Torah during this time of the 9 days. And as well, you know, to speak about the concept of Shemira Salashin, about Lashon Hara or Lashon Tov. The topic I decided to discuss tonight is words that build, words that heal. There's so much we hear over and over and over again about the destructive power of Lashon Hara, about the importance of Shemira Salashin, the campaigns from the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation to try to cut down on Lashon Hara. And I wanted to address the point in a slightly different direction, in a direction to find even more meaning and to hopefully strike a chord in a very, very holistic and really to try to deal with the root of the problem as opposed to dealing with some of the symptoms. Now, of course, every little bit we do is always good, is always mekubal, lifnei Hashem, is always received, lifnei Hashem, as the Rambam says, that anyone who wants to, who tries to put their best foot forward in Hilchos Tshuva, he says that every little bit is nechshav, as is thought of, as a tremendous, tremendous stride. And it's something that we all have our struggles with in terms of our speech, in terms of how we speak about people, how we speak about things. And the problem seems to only have been magnified, of course, with the advent of social media. Previously, you could only tell the people who you actually had contact with different things, could tell them stories. Now it's possible to share ideas across the globe. And of course, with everything, it cuts both ways. Just about everything in the world cuts both ways. Whether it's nuclear power that we can use to power cities with, or to level cities, level states. Similarly, the internet and social media allows us to share ideas, to share good words across cities, towns, states, countries. We can also destroy people across the world. And I'd like to think about our ability to use this faculty of speech, Latov. So I wanted to go back to the very, very beginning, in terms of our conceptualization of speech, in terms of how do we think about talking. I know it's a little metacognitive, but how do we think about thinking? It's funny, I have an 11th grader, Gitti, and she loves to use the phrase metacognition. Now, Gitti is also a medicine buff. She's hoping to go for her MD. So she's always walking around with an anatomy textbook, which is kind of funny. This 11th grader always schlepping around her college anatomy. I mean, thank God it's not organic chemistry yet, so we can still understand a little bit of what she's talking about. But she's always walking around with her anatomy textbook, rattling off words. But her favorite word that she's picked up from me is metacognition. How do we think about thinking? So I want to unpack a little bit together our thoughts of how we speak and our thoughts of how we speak. Because pretty much we start speaking since we're little kids, and we thank God don't stop talking. And even in Judaism, so much of what we have to do has to do with words and with talking. We come to shul 3 times a day, and we open up a siddur and we say words, and we come to shiurim, or we learn Torah, and that's also all about words. And even our comedy, so much of our jokes, and definitely rabbi jokes, have to do with, we have a whole type of jokes called rabbi jokes. Which also my daughter likes to joke that rabbi dad jokes are the worst. If rabbi jokes are bad, dad jokes are bad, so rabbi dad jokes are horrible. Rabbi dad jokes get like two eye rolls in the presence of any teenager. So rabbi dad jokes. But it revolves so much around wordplay. So much of Torah study has to do with the analysis of words. Of words and conceptualizations. Of how we speak, how things were said, why they were said, to whom they were said. So why is that? So I want to go way, way, way back. I mean, even when you think about it, we have Torah, which is the written word, Torah Shebichtav, which is the written Torah, and Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral word. All of our lives as Jews is dealing with words and speech. And diction, even grammar, so much boils down to the spoken word. And the funny thing is that when we go all the way back to the beginning, gracious, God creates the world by speaking with words. That's fantastic because we really don't pay so much attention to it because we're just so used to the fact that, you know, God said, let there be light, and there was light. And we just sort of pass over that when it's screaming from the pages of the Chumash, God created the world. The Torah says that God creates the world through speech. Through speech. Through talking. And, you know, if there wasn't enough, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos reflects on this with the statement that we know that there are sar mamaros shebo nivra olam, that there are 10 utterances. With 10 utterances, God creates the world. So, of course, an incredibly rabbinic movement. We say, 10? You couldn't have done it with one? Right? You couldn't have done it with one? Why'd you have to be 10? 10 utterances. God spoke. Once again, we're coming back to this faculty of speech is something significant. The faculty of speech is used to create the world. The Torah, that's what the Torah is telling us. That through speech, the world is created. And why did it take 10 utterances? Couldn't you have done it better? It's like, kid comes home from school, they come home with a 95. What happened to the other 5 points? And it's something we all promulgate on our children also. I said to Shemi, my son Shemi came home, hit 99. Ah, but I got a 99. I said, Shemi, you're great. It was awesome. But just because we have a tradition to do this, what happened to the other points? It gets to the point now that we'll all do it together, even the kid with the test. And what happened to the other point? Of course, that you say, you did great, that was unbelievable. We don't care what happened, but we feel like we have to say what happened to the other point. So back to the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Why 10 utterances? You could have done it with one God. And the Mishnah says, well, this is to create a punishment for people who destroy the world that's created with 10 utterances. I'm not going to focus on this Mishnah right now in depth, but the fact of the matter is the world is created with words. There's a lot to do with, in modern philosophy, especially postmodern philosophy, the notion of the creation of a narrative. Also in psychotherapy, what is your narrative? How do I tell the story of my life? How do we tell the story of our lives? The power to tell a story, you know, in no less words, creates your world. How do I look at my world, at my life? How do I color it? What words do I use to describe it? What are the words that I use for my narrative? This storytelling, this telling, use of the power of speech is, we say, Bezer Anpin, a miniature of how God went and created the world. God creates the world through speech. He describes the world through speech. In fact, there's a sefer known as Sefer Yetzirah, referenced in the Gemara. Could be the same one that we have in our possession. And it's a book all about speech, all about letters and words and vowels and grammar. Speech. Speech describes worlds, speech creates worlds, both in a metaphysical sense and, of course, in a cognitive, psychological sense. How do I see my world? What's my narrative? How do I perceive my world?
all conveyed through speech. I can create a world. God creates the world through words.
Even we know that the Gemara that describes how some of the Amorim created animals through Sefer Yetzirah, through the manipulation of these letters.
When we think about what we just said over there, leaving the mysticism aside, the idea is that words create reality. It creates our narrative, it creates how we think about things. The most real thing to us in our world is how do we see the world, and how do we describe that world that we see? Words quite literally create the world, create worlds, create our lives.
So let me share with you a famous midrash about Shmiras HaLashon, with a slightly different twist of its interpretation. We note that the Midrash tells us a story that there was once this Rochel, and again we see the Gemara's love of words, the Gemara's love of wordplay. Why? Because Rochel, on one hand, means a merchant, but also Rochel can mean a slanderer. That rabbinic love of wordplay right over there also. That significance of saying that a Rochel, there was this guy, Hahu Rochel, that guy. Hahu, that Rochel, that merchant, he was going around. And he runs the streets saying, Man baya same dechaya. Who wants an elixir of life? Right. We're going to get to it in a second. Absolutely. So he's going through the street saying, who wants life? Who wants life? Come get life. Who wants the elixir of life? You used to see it, if anyone remembers, the reproductions of this year's Robox catalogs. Not like the glossy ones, but the old ones, where it's talking about this elixir of life. And this is a very, very common thing that people would go around selling the elixir of life. If anyone remembers the Oklahoma, Play Oklahoma, there was a merchant that figured prominently also in that play, where he's also trying to sell this type of elixir of life. People are always looking for the elixir of life. Ponce de Leon, of course, is looking for the fountain of life. So one guy is wandering around, the midrash says, he's wandering around saying, who wants life? I've got the Sam HaChaim. I have the elixir of life. He gets everybody into the town. And Rabbi Yanai comes over and says, ooh, you know, back isn't what it used to be. You know, I've got that crook in my elbow. My Gemara thumb is a little achy right now. Maybe I could use some of this elixir of life. And the Rochel, the merchant, says to him, no, it's not for you, it's not for people like you. But Rabbi Yanai starts to press him. And he's like, oh, come on, want the goods. So he takes out a Sefer Tehillim, and he says, here it is, let me show you. Who is the one who wants life? He loves days, he wants to see good. Guard your tongue from speaking evil. Right? Guard your tongue from speaking evil. And your lips from speaking badly. This Medrash, when we read the Pasuk, we understand what the Medrash is doing. The Medrash is explaining these words, right? It says, David HaMelech says, no, who is the one who wants life? You want life? Stay away from evil speech. Stay away from bad speech if you really want life. And from there, so the Midrash says, oh, look, there's the story of the Rochel. It fits very, very nicely, whether it's a parable, whether this is an actual historical Rochel that was around this salesman. But the Midrash says, this is the meaning of the Pasuk. Shlomo Freifeld frames the story totally differently. And it's a fantastic, fantastic read of this Midrash. So normally, the formula that we have for the understanding of the story is that, it's almost like a fairy tale, he says, uses this word, these words, it's almost like a fairy tale that there's a very whimsical, this whimsical character of this merchant sweeps into town, seeming to sell snake oil, and then gets everybody together, and then pulls a fast one on them and says, look at Tehillim. It says in Tehillim, guard your lips from speaking evil. Freifeld says, no. The way to really understand this pasuk, to really understand if you want life, stay away from Lashon Hara, it's not just dealing with a symptom of slander. It's not just dealing with a symptom of people who are speaking evil. No, that's not what it's about. It says the truth is that a person whose life is consumed with Lashon Hara, is consumed with speaking badly about people, and we're all guilty of it. I'll speak for myself. I assume everyone is better. But we all struggle with this issue. We all struggle with speaking badly about people. But what he says is somebody whose self-concept is so devoted to speaking about other people, his life is not life. Right? It's not saying, oh, be careful what you're going to say, otherwise you're going to get zapped. Right? You want life? Stay away from Lashon Hara. He's saying, no. Unpack it the other direction. Do you want to really live? Do you want to really, really live? Live your own life. And don't be so concerned about what everybody else is all about. Make your conversation more about you, more about ideas, and less about Yenem. Yet less about everybody else. Because a person whose life is subsumed, you become a rochel. You're somebody who goes around, I have a story about him, I have a story about her, and you should have heard what this one did, you should have heard what that one did, and what she served, and what she wore, and what he did. Your life is not life. Your life is filled with criticisms of the other person. Filled with criticisms of the world, filled with criticisms of other people. Nobody zoytze by you. Nobody passes your inspecting eye. Your life is not life. It's so kashur, it's so chained to talking about what everybody else did. The eye does not turn it internally. And that's the biggest problem. You know, when we sit down, you sit down with a bunch of people and immediately the talk goes to talking about what everybody else is doing. Assassination of character. And the biggest scandal, the newest talk about what's going on. That's not life. That's not living. So, David Melech, though, gives us a prescription. It's not just the snake oil. And it's not just Netzor Lashon Chamer, right? Don't stop talking evil. But there's another pasuk which we don't always hear, which is not always emphasized. Sur Mira V'yase Tov. Right? Stop doing bad, but also do good. Right? It's not just, okay, so sit there in the corner and don't say anything. There's plenty of good diburim. There's plenty of good things to talk about. There's plenty of good stuff to say. It's not just, that when speaking about Shmiras Halashon, that we want you to sit in the corner and just be like a mime, right? Don't say anything at all. People say that actually the Chafetz Chaim was very, very talkative. He was very, very talkative. You'd think that he would sit in the corner and not say anything. He was very, very talkative. There's a lot of good stuff to say. There's a lot of good things to talk about. But we have to begin to start to turn things around. We have to begin to alter our perspective. We have to start using this power of Sur Mira V'Asei Tov. Subsist from looking at everything with this critical eye and start looking for positive things. Start looking to heal. Start looking to build. Like we said, our words create a narrative. Words create. Words build. Words heal. So how can we do this? I'll tell you a story that just happened to us. It was wild. We went to go visit my son for visiting day on Sunday. And we get off of Route 17, right in Pennsylvania over there, get off the expressway, the quickway, I think the throughway, no, not the throughway, the quickway they call it. We pull off, and all of a sudden something starts sounding a little funny in the car. Baruch Hashem, my father taught me what sounds funny in a car, and at least to know what sounds funny in a car. Sometimes I even know what to do about it also. Baruch Hashem, it's something we're imparting to the kids. You should always know, we should have a compressor and a fix-a-flat and the jack and the lug wrench and a spare. We're very well prepared. and a good upbringing. So I hear something's going wrong. I immediately get off the expressway. I pull over to the gas station. It was right over there at the exit. I look and the tire is flat. So I say, okay, we can handle a flat tire. We're not afraid. Flat tires don't scare us. So immediately I start filling the tire with air. A little fix-a-flat. It was a little bit of a bubble, which I really should have known better. But I start driving on the tires. Okay, the tire's filled up again. Well, maybe we'll get to camp. We'll see how it is. The camp's only 10 minutes away from where we got the flat. We're going. 2 minutes out, all of a sudden, poof, I'm like, knew I shouldn't have driven. Okay, fine. So, pull into another parking lot, get down, get the jack out of the car, have the lug wrench, get the spare out, jack up the car, pull out the spare tire. I get the lug wrench out, and all of a sudden, the lug wrench doesn't fit on the tire. I don't know. It came with a car. It came with a car. I don't know what happened. It came with a car. It doesn't fit on the lug nuts. Okay, fine. I look at the spare. On one of the seams of the spare, it's ripped. You can see the tube. This does not look good. At this point, I admit defeat and I call AAA. So a nice from couple comes by, picks up my wife and kids and brings them over to camp, while the husband sits and waits with me till AAA comes. His wife comes back, AAA comes, picks up my car, whisks me to the service station. As luck would have it, they don't have a tire for me. They don't have a tire. They said, we have 225, 215, but no 235. Is there anyone anywhere where you can go? Well, there's a Walmart 35 miles away, but I call them, yes, we have your tire, but we can't put it on until tomorrow. Said another direction, same thing, we have a tire, we're not going to be able to put it on until like tomorrow night. So I'm like, okay, fine. So I'm there, I'm like, okay, fine, I'll leave the car with these guys. They say, we'll have the tire for you midday and you'll be off and going. So now I'm in the middle of Pennsylvania. Right, by Morishah. So, no, Pendle, where am I supposed to go? So they take me back to camp. We'll figure it out. So Rav Willig is running the Morishah Kollel. He says, okay, no problem. Come stay with us. We go there. We have nothing. We have the shirts on our back, and that's it. They found a place for us. We come in, and they make a siyum. Right? They have a siyum. So we have fleishigs, we have a nice fleishig meal in Pennsylvania. And we're sitting there, and so we have Shimi and Nechama, ages 13 and 10. So they're running around camp playing basketball. And they're happy, so I could sit down and have a little bit of quiet time. We have food to eat, we have minyanim. So my wife and I were talking about, that was crazy. But at the end of the day, if you're going to break down, right? If you're going to break down, at least it should be right 10 minutes from your destination, or you have food to eat, a minyan to daven with, towels to fill and to use. Of all the crazy situations, it shouldn't happen, but at least, not bad. So there's two ways, of course, that we can look at the story. We can either look, oh my God, I lost 2 days of work already. There's a lot of things that I needed to be doing. And sitting here in Pennsylvania for 48 hours is not one of them. And why should it have to happen like this? And what am I supposed to do about all this? Or the other way to look at it is, okay, it's a little bit of inconvenience, but if you had to break down, better to be broken down with a whole bunch of friends and fleishigs during the 9 days. I mean, come on. come on. Not bad. Not bad. Sur mirav yaseh tov requires an attitude adjustment sometimes. Now, it's not always easy to, in the immortal words of Monty Python, to always look on the bright side of life. It's not easy because sometimes circumstances are much more difficult than just a flat tire and the loss of a day. But in terms of this constant pursuit of trying to spin my narrative a little bit different, Rabbi Nachman has a famous teaching in which He says that this is the entire mystery of life, of trying to create this new narrative, and the power that our ability to create this new narrative has on us. Our cognition, our thoughts, actually become the way that we view the world. The more dark, the more cynically we look at the world, the more this shades the way that we interact with the world, it creates a darker narrative. And the more we're in pursuit of the brighter side, looking at it as a challenge with possibilities, as opposed to a dead end, it colors the way that we think about it. In cognitive behavioral therapy, part of what we're working on is trying to see what the inner discussion is about. What's your self-talk, is the jargon that we'll use. What's the self-talk? What is the way that you're thinking about the situation? What is the narrative that you've created? How do you view this entire situation? Sur mera v'yaseh tov. How can we heal our speech? It is a matter of trying to heal our perspective. Person can walk around looking for things, looking to find things wrong, or looking to find things right. It depends on how we want to commit ourselves to this pursuit. The challenge of Sur Mira V'Yaseh Tov, and the challenge of trying to heal our speech, how we talk about things, is part and parcel of the mystery of tshuva. Rav Kook, in the beginning of his Sefer Or HaTshuva, or as a tshuva, says that in actuality, that part of tshuva is all about trying to return health and life to an area of our lives that we ourselves have caused this weakening. We've caused this this dildula chayim, as he says in a poetic Hebrew like that. What can you do? Dildula chayim, it is what it sounds like. Right? Dildul, like to impoverishment. Dildul, a weakening. The dildul achayim. We caused it, and we can fix it. This ability, I mean, I'm sure that it's something I inherited, of course, from my dad. This attitude of, you can always fix it. What do you mean? Of course you can fix it. That's the question. You can fix it. But, you know, with enough solder and crazy glue and duct tape and with the right, we can fix it. And to pursue this idea in our lives also. Look at the world. How can I acquire this Weltanschauung, this worldview of its possibilities? It's not over. It's not done with. A lighter perspective. A search for light as opposed to a search for darkness. And it's within our ability to heal. So I want to provide two different tools that we can use. One of them is based, one of them is CBT plus a little bit of Rav Kook, and then another tool for, didn't have a great smach from it, but it could be a pasuk in Yirmiyahu and from the work of Dr. John Gottman. So first let's deal with the Rav Kook. In terms of our challenge and our search for ways to heal our speech. So here's one tool that we can use to try to heal our speech. There's a Gemara in Maseches Shabbos in which there's a discussion about whether or not a person is allowed to read by a candlelight. And of course, there's a danger of reading by candlelight because back in the old days, I mean, these lights, you look at them, there's not much you can do with them. But a candle, we're afraid that it's not burning evenly. And normally, a person wants to move the candle a little bit to make sure you get to assure an even burn and get enough light to read. So, Chazal made a takana and said, look, can't read by the light of a candle because we're afraid that you're going to tilt the candle to make it brighter. Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha says, you know what? Ani ekra loeta. I'm gonna read by the candle because I know myself. I'm not gonna go and tilt the candle. Pamachad, one time it happened, kra ubikesh latos, and he wanted to turn it. Amar kamagadolim devar chachamim ha. So he said, "Oh wow, unbelievable! I see that I had the urge once to do it. They're right." Rabbi Nasan Amar Kra. No. He actually did it once. Vihita. And he turned the candle. He did actually, turn it and cause it to burn differently. The Kasav Alpin Kasav. So what happened? He took out his notebook. Ani Yishmol Ben Elisha Karasi. Vehetisi Ner Vashabas. Avi chatat shmeina. I will bring a big, fat chatat offering. He writes it in a book. He goes, he sits down, writes it in a book. So what does this have to do with our discussion? Rav Kook says, people are complicated. It's Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal. When asked by Rabbi Chaim Sabato, Yibadel Chaim, in the epic book, In the Search of His Presence, also known as Mevakshe Panecha. So, Rav Sabato asked Rav Lichtenstein, why did you go to Harvard? What did you learn in Harvard? Rav Lichtenstein said, in Harvard I learned, Kama Ben Adam Mesubach Ve'olam Mesubach. How people are complicated and the world is complicated. Rav Kook, here as well, says the same thing. People are complicated. Oftentimes, we are a mixture of different drives, thoughts, and feelings. He says, Ki hakochot hanafshiim shebaadam upulotav hapratiyot hema achuzim vesibuchim ze bezeh. Thoughts, feelings, cognitions, they're all wrapped all together. The human situation is a complicated one, Rav Kook says. So therefore, when it happens that all of a sudden you have a moment of insight, it's very, very important, Rav Kook says, to write it down. Tell you. Because we know that every day it's a new adventure. Every day we have a different perspective on life. We have different flashes of insight about ourselves and our lives. We think differently about our lives. We have different thoughts about our life, about the human condition. And if you don't note them, they'll be gone in a moment. This is also slightly autobiographical, because Rav Kook was an intense journaler, and his journals they're still publishing and typesetting them today. We have breathtaking thoughts that Rav Kook would journal, the different thoughts, which form a large portion of his corpus, of his literary output, are these journals of these different flashes of insight and thoughts that he would have. So, the human condition is such that we have lots and lots of different thoughts and feelings. And especially when it comes to self-improvement, we have what we call in the field a defense mechanism, a rationalization, right? We have that we cover ourselves a lot. Very few people will say that they think that they're doing the wrong thing. It takes a lot for a person to actually think that they're doing the wrong thing while they're doing the wrong thing. A lot of times they'll think that they're doing the right thing, then later you'll have the insight to see that you're doing the wrong thing. But very, very few people actually actively look to do the wrong thing. Sometimes they'll act out of impulse. They'll act out of pain. They'll act out of a certain feeling. And then they'll realize that was the wrong thing. So, what the advice that Rav Kook is proffering for us, in terms of our plan of trying to better speech, sometimes when we realize that we said the wrong thing, we have the opportunity to journal it a little bit. Right? You'll see what I'm going to do with this. Journal it, write what it was that you said. Why did you say it? Now, here, because even from the missteps, as Rav Kook says in one place, that you can take a misstep and turn it into a learning experience. When we speak Lashon Hara about someone, what was the cause of that speech? Why did we do it? Why did we do that exactly? Is it because we were hurt? That they hurt me, so I'm going to hurt them back? Is it I'm looking for acceptance from people around me? Is it because I'm looking for, I want to feel better about myself? But there's lots of different motivations. You know, everybody, lev yodeh ma'aretz nafsho. Everybody knows, you know, what makes themselves tick. But write down for you, for only you, but for you, to say, what did I learn about myself from this mistake? How can I do it better? Sometimes, you know, we'll say something negative about something, nasty about someone, because look, it looks like they have everything. It looks like they got it all together. And in my mind, taking them down a notch makes me feel so much better about myself. Or sometimes, it's about wanting to fit in, right? And say like, well, what's everyone going to say about me if I don't contribute to this group discussion? Well, what are people going to say about me if I say, you know what, guys? You know, I'm not so interested. Let's talk about the Mets. You want to upset yourself, you know. But I have two sons who are diehard Yankees fans and two daughters who are not diehard, but pretty hard Yankees fans. One of them even cheered for Derek Jeter at a Mets game. It happens. What was it? Where did that come from? What did it do for me? Because I was looking for something there. There's a reason why you did that. What do I need? Is there a better way to get it? Right? It's a tremendous thing because this, what you can do, what you can make out of this situation is an unbelievable learning experience about yourself. What were you looking for? How can I bring my life back to life? Instead of being meshubad to thinking about looking for negative things for other people so that I can feel good about myself, why can't I look to myself about positive things to feel good about myself? Why can't I look to myself, find what it is that I need and get it a different way? We call sublimation. Transform that drive to use it in a different way. Uplift myself. Right? Uplift myself. Change the way that I do things. Think about it. Right? In a way that we don't have to carry guilt around for it, we're trying to be better. Say, I don't want to go back to that place, so how can I learn from my mistakes? How can I learn from my mistakes? Rav Kook says, "Umotze meshkiyot limudim niskavim." Tshuva has the ability to find from my missteps the most effervescent, learning experiences. It's unbelievable to take this and transform what was a bad experience, a misstep, and convert it. Learn about yourself and be better. Heal. It's a fantastic, fantastic insight. Second, another tool that you can use. Dr. John Gottman, one of the premier couples therapists in our time, has a concept which he calls the four horsemen, right? The four horsemen of the apocalypse. He watched thousands of hours, and his research staff also, watched thousands of hours of couples interacting in what they call the Love Lab, which is an apartment set up with cameras so that they can record the interactions between couples. And they, by examining the videotape, instant replay, right? They found the masters and the disasters of couples' communication. And they said that the disasters do four things. These four different actions. And they do them repeatedly. And that's why he calls them the four horsemen of the apocalypse. He said, because if you keep doing this, it's going to lead to bad results down the road. These four horsemen are four behavioral patterns which cause your interactions with your spouse, and truth is with anybody who you interact with, to be flavored with what we call the fight or flight response. The message that your body is giving you is this is dangerous. This is danger. React with fight or run away, right? Or become physiologically flooded and shut down. Those are three experiences. When a person is in danger, they'll do one of those three things. Either fight, run away, or shut down. So what John Gottman says, what Dr. Gottman says, is that there are these four things that couples do when they fight, or four things that people really do when they fight. Criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling. Right? So each one of them, when you do this in a relationship, is going to do what he calls a negative feedback loop, and it is what it sounds like. You get involved in negative feedback, and you keep doing it over and over and over again, hence a negative feedback loop. Meaning that this interaction is not a positive experience. This is something which causes me stress. Keep doing that, and you know, you'll want to avoid the stress somehow. I want to focus in just on one for right now because it's germane to our discussion, although it's a wonderful discussion and something worthwhile to look into in much greater depth. The horseman known as contempt. The horseman known as contempt is when a person goes and says to their significant other, or like we said, truthfully, anyone, "You're such a mess up. Such a moron. Can't you do anything right?" Contempt. You interact with people in a way that you put them down constantly. So this is dangerous for a person's relationship for two reasons, John Gottman says. Number one, it's dangerous because you're criticizing the other person and you're not generally not being a nice person to them. That's first. The second is that you're defining them with a negative concept. And this will color all of your interactions, that you'll always look at them as someone who can't get anything right, as somebody who's always doing the wrong thing, as a mess up. "You're so stupid, you don't listen," all those different utterances. And John Gottman says, replace it with building a culture of mutual appreciation. Go out of your way to compliment each other. He says, because this creates a positive feedback loop. "You're so thoughtful. Thank you so much for that." Appreciate each other for all the good that you do to each other. And articulate it. Why? Because it becomes part of your narrative. Because, linking it back to what I said at the beginning, Ribbono Shel Olam created the world through speech, Torah tells us. And we continue to create worlds through speech. We continue to create narratives through speech. We continue to create the way that we view the world through our words. Our world is built by the words that we say. And therefore, the way that we conceptualize the world that we interact with, the way that we describe it, it becomes our reality. We can heal our speech in two different ways. We can heal our speech in number one, to try to understand and get at what we were looking for when we messed up. And then we can also heal our speech by increasing the positive diburim, increasing the positive speech, to speak well about people, to say good things about people, good things about our children, good things about our spouses, good things about our friends. Finding good things to say about people who we disagree with. To search for that good, to let that good flavor and color our interactions. So that our life, as Rafaifa would say, can become life again. As Rav Kook said, to return back to life, as Rav Kook was saying in the Orta Tshuva. To return ourselves back to life, which is life. To turn ourselves back to a positive perspective in which our life is not enslaved to everybody else's reality, but I'm creating my own reality that doesn't have to do with criticizing everybody else. And people will return in kind. You know, I published a book on Ishbitz Radzin, which is a complicated Hasidic philosophy dealing with a person's inner motives and drives. And sometimes the translation was complicated. And I had an editor who couldn't do the job, so she handed me off to a different editor. And the editor took one look at the manuscript and gave me an email filled with contempt. You know, did you write this in crayon? Like, do you understand how words work? It was like really, really nasty. So I responded back to him, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to working with you, right, in trying to make to improve my manuscript. I'm looking forward to see in what way that you can aid me. Okay, so let's get to it. He responds. And it doesn't always work with such immediacy. It doesn't always work. There are pessimistic, critical people in the world. They're carrying so much stuff with them. But doesn't it make our lives that much better? Doesn't it enrich our lives that much more to try to live our lives? To live our lives, the lives of fulfillment, lives of meaning, as opposed to, you know, to running around just always being overtaken by thoughts of what everyone else is doing, what everyone else is saying. Live our own lives. Another quote from that we ended off. Oh, we didn't end off, I'm sorry. In the Nevuah of Yirmiyahu that we quote during Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, and it's also the Haftorah of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Haven Yakir li Ephraim, Imyal et Shashum, is Ephraim now a favorite son, right? Where Hashem is speaking through Yirmiyahu, talking about the northern kingdom. Isn't he such a delightful child? Ki midei dabribo, zachar es kirenuo. The more that I speak of him, the more I remember. And the more I'll have compassion on him. The more that I speak about it, the Navi is describing a phenomenon. The more I speak positively, the more I will elicit positive emotions. The more I will flavor my narrative positively. So Dr. Gottman says, I believe we're going to find that respect and affection are essential to all relationships. Are essential to all relationships working, and contempt destroys them. It all depends on how we want to color our narratives. If we change our narrative, if we realize when we're speaking out of pain, how we're speaking out of pain, we can heal our speech. We can heal how we're speaking. I wanted to conclude with a thought from the Maral. I saw it when preparing for Shir last week and was incredibly taken by it. We know that there's a famous Gemara that talks about what was the demise of the Batei HaMikdash. We know that the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed through Gilui Reish, because Damim of Avodah Zarah, through idol worship, through licentious behavior, and through bloodshed. And the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed through hate. The Maral says, he said, to understand it simply, what does that make sense? How does that make sense at all? First Beis HaMikdash is destroyed through these three great sins, and the second one, they hated each other? So the Maral says something fantastic. I want to hone in just on the second Beis HaMikdash. He said, when you think about it, what was the entire point of the first Beis HaMikdash? It's that Am Yisrael had a Beis HaMikdash. The Jewish people had a Beis HaMikdash. The second temple period, how much of it was really Jewish self-dominion? How much of it was there really Jews in charge? It was built under the Persians. Then the Persians were conquered by the Greeks. Ultimately, several Greek kings in the Chashmonaim revolt, right? The Chashmonaim revolt overthrow the Greeks. Then the Chashmonaim start fighting with themselves and bringing the Romans. And Herod takes over and makes the place all nice. Self-dominion? Not so much. Is the Shekhinah present, the Gemara says? Not so much. What's the point that there was a Beis HaMikdash, the Maharal says? Is there was Am Yisrael's Beis HaMikdash. There was one Beis HaMikdash. There was one Kohen Gadol. There was one Mizbeach. It was a focal point for us. At least we were there, and it was an Am Yisrael together. Yeah. And ultimately, what destroyed it was once it wasn't us together anymore. Once there was the infighting, the Tzdukim and the Prushim and the Essenes, right, the Bnei Ha'or, and people running up to mountaintops and Medi, and everybody, the Sikari, everybody's fighting each other. So what do we need a Beis HaMikdash for? If there's a Beis HaMikdash, then it's because we're all together, he said. That the only merit that we had this place was is for us to be together. If we're not together, so what do we need it? Why should we have it? And he said, that's what it means that Sin Eschinim destroyed it. Because the only reason was because there was a nation. So we're all together. At the end of the day, all we have is each other. The Midrash says that there's no Kohen Gadol, there's no Beis HaMikdash, there's no Korbanos, there's no Sanhedrin. We have communities scattered all over the place. All we have is each other. So can't we try to get it together a little bit more? So the message for the 3 weeks then, for the 9 days, because we're still dealing with this issue, is that, you know, let's just try to get it together. We're all each other have left. You know? The Am Yisrael is all, for us, we're all we have left. So understand, this one doesn't agree with this one, that one doesn't agree. We're all we have left. You know, to make it a little bit more sharp, we can imagine after the war, when there's no one left of a person's family, there's this person and one other, like, distant cousin. That distant cousin all of a sudden became that person's brother. Even though it's like a third cousin four times removed, because they're all they have left. They're all we have left. When you have the luxury of having, you know, of having a lot of people, so okay, you have the luxury of not talking to each other. Or as Rav Shach one time said to Rav Amital, he said, Yehuda, Rav Yehuda, we're so far apart we can't even argue anymore. But we should understand that, or Rav Mirsky, Rabbi Dr. Mirsky in his book, Rav Kook, one of the first English biographies of Rav Kook, he says that for all of the sectarianism that existed at the time of the Hakamat Medina, when the state was founded, they were all arguing about something, but they were arguing together. They were arguing together. And now, you know, unfortunately, there's been such a fractionalization of the communities that they don't even argue anymore. They don't even interact. Thank God there are positive signs. Things are starting to come a little bit back together. A bunch of different phenomena, at least, that I've seen. But part of, you know, wanting to heal our speech, part of wanting to repair, to heal, to build, to repair, is to have the overwhelming thought, to be consumed with the drive of we're all each other of God. Let's try to make it work together. Let's really, really, bam, it's a try. To set aside all of the things that, you know, all the different things, whether it's a personal squabble, whether it's money, whether it's machloichsim, whatever it is, let's try to let it go. Let's try to heal our speech. Let's try to acquire much more positive outlook, and let's create a brand new narrative. And then, and it's interesting to say that the promise that the Navi tells us, that they will sing a Shir Chadash. We'll sing a new song. And what's a song but a story worth set to music? Maybe Zoichas, to hear the song again, to create this new narrative, to increase the positivity which is out there, to change our narratives, and ultimately bring a greater healing for all of us. Thank you so much for listening.